State Representative Greg Harris, a Chicago Democrat, says we're in unprecedented territory with our 20-month-long state budget impasse.
This is the way it has been done for 198 years of the 200 years of our state's history. Only in the last 2 years has it ended up this way.
We talk about the latest in Illinois politics in our weekly political reporter roundtable. Also, how is a Division III basketball team using computer science to help improve their team's record?
Being a smaller school with a limited budget, with a limited staff, I felt that we were kind of at a disadvantage, so I wanted to try to find something that would kind of even the playing field.
We talked to the coach and the data scientist working with the Illinois Institute of Technology's basketball team. But first, a reading list of books to help make you smarter about the information you're consuming. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. It's President's Day for all of you that have the day off. I hope you're enjoying the holiday. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Even before all the talk of fake news, there's no question we were already inundated on all sides by information, whether we're talking about social media, other places online, and yes, even us, the traditional media. But how can you, those of you who are listening right now, make yourself better judges of information and become better critical thinkers? Well, as we like to do occasionally on the 21st, we like to compile reading lists and reach out to librarians to create those for us. In the coming weeks, we're going to be creating reading lists that can help you escape from it all, whether we're talking about fiction or nonfiction books. Today, though, we wanted to start with books that can help make you smarter about the information that we are consuming. As always, you're welcome to chime in with your recommendations and comments. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Or you can tweet to 21st Show. Our handle, again, 21ST Show. In studio with me, librarian Nicole Cook is an assistant professor at the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois. Nicole, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I think certainly some people want to escape it all. And everyone's seen sort of like the No Facebook February because they're tired of news or people fighting over the news and politics. But do you feel like there's another segment of the population that feels like, no, I need to be spending more time educating myself? Mm-hmm. You're nodding your head.
Yes, absolutely. I think that there are a lot of people who think, well, I might be missing something, or I can't believe that this particular program or person said this, so I need to know as much as I can find out to counteract some of the things that they may be hearing that either they don't agree with or they're not sure about. So I think there are lots of people who have that kind of disposition to find out as much as they can.
And last time we had you on the program, we will find the link and tweet it out to that conversation, by the way. You were here to talk about how librarians sort out mm-hmm. fake news sites, how librarians are looking kind of do sources through social media feeds and kind of figure out, this is legitimate source, this isn't. But I think that now, I imagine, the last time you were on was immediately after the election. I wonder how many people have come up to you in the past month or two and said, hey, Nicole, I really feel like I need to learn to do sort of the job that journalists do or librarians do and do a little bit better job of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm still getting people that say, I didn't know about fake news. Fake news is new to me. And then I have that conversation with them about maybe the title is new, right? But we've always had instances of fake news and things of that nature. And just a lot of people, to your point, how do I kind of combat this? How do I know what's fake and what's not? We even had a workshop at the school that I teach at, and we had almost 100 people online and in person really wanting to get some tips and tricks about how to be better consumers, how to be more savvy in terms of the information that they actually absorb and use.
So we have, Nicole, you have very helpfully compiled a list for us that we are going to go through now. We've tweeted out the entire list as well. If you follow 21st Show, 21ST Show, you've got the books that Nicole and I are going to be talking about. And I wanted to start with the first book on your list. It's Daniel Levitin's A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. And the one thing, you and I were just talking about this before we went on air. The one thing that made me realize when I read this book is, I didn't think about the fact that as a journalist, it's my job to do this. I just maybe do it automatically. As a librarian, this is something you do. I wanted to actually start our conversation by playing something. We spoke to Dan last year when the book first came out. Here's what he said about why he decided to write this book.
what made me really put the effort into high gear is this strange situation we find ourselves in now, where information is available almost instantaneously, but it's mixed in with a bunch of misinformation, and science is mixed in with pseudoscience, and there are a whole bunch of websites that are, you know, saying stuff that simply isn't true. And the average person's defenseless against this. There's no gatekeeper for the internet.
That's Dan Levitin. He was on the program last year talking about his book, Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. In studio with me, Nicole Cook is an assistant professor in the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois. She has compiled a reading list for us. Why did you start off with Dan Levitin's book?
I started with that book not only because it's newer, but I found it just really accessible. So to your point about being a trained journalist, being a trained information professional or a librarian, these are things that we don't think about. So these are skills and techniques that we've been trained to do. But when we're dealing with public, when we're dealing with folks who are not trained, I think this book gives a lot of tips and tricks that are very accessible and that make a lot of sense right away.
And what were the biggest takeaways from you from this book? What were those tips?
Levitin talked about counter knowledge, which is the point that stuck out to me. And this idea that facts and also some non-facts, if you will, can be packaged in such a way that they're not questioned. So to the clip that you just played, if consumers are inundated with all of this information and they're hearing something from a source that perhaps they trust on a regular basis, if some things are slipped in that are mistruths or perhaps omissions or things
or
of that nature.
Or complete lies.
Or complete lies, yes. They may not flag that for themselves because it's almost like playing two truths and a lie. Like you hear the two truths and you hear the one lie. Maybe you don't catch that. Maybe you don't understand what's being put out there.
Yeah, so that's an interesting way to think about it, that the idea of, so not only just being aware of that, but then can you a little bit more about this whole notion of counter facts?
So counter knowledge. We could say counter facts. So this idea that we have a range of information, right? And what we're seeing in the fake news is really misinformation and disinformation. So misinformation would be just, you know, facts that are flying around, some that may not be true for various reasons, right? It may just be a mistake. It could be that someone actually wants to deceive you. And then when someone actually wants to deceive you for whatever reason, then we move into disinformation. And that implies that there's some type of malintent or maliciousness behind this false information. So that's really what counter knowledge is. And so things that we just normally accept as truth, there are more dimensions to that now. And so we need to be more vigilant about actually pulling out the truth and kind of, you know, separating the wheat from the chaff, if you will, about what information is not true, what's not factual, what's not malicious.
So that's the number one on this list, Dan Levitin's A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. There were some interesting things I learned in here, even about sourcing, how to look on sources for websites. And there's some things I've always done as a journalist, but even there's a couple sites that he pointed to, Google Scholars, lots of places that are on the internet to sort of help you sort out all of that information as well. While I'm thinking about that, Nicole, are there good websites you recommend? Like Google Scholar is one. Can you explain that a little bit for people who aren't familiar?
Sure. So Google Scholar is almost the academic version, if you will, of Google. So Google Scholar, you can type in, say, my name. You could type in the name of probably Levitin and some other authors, and you will get their books and you will get their articles and their material that we consider scholarly, if you will. And by that, we mean that a lot of this information has gone through peer review.
I was going to say they're peer reviewed.
Yes. And so that means that they were reviewed by a panel of experts and they were deemed worthy to be published to add to a particular body of knowledge. So this is information that has gone through quite a stringent review before it's even published. And so if you're looking for articles and books of that nature and you're going to Google Scholar, then you know that there's some level already of vetting, right, that you don't need to do. It's already been done for you.
Right. And that leads us to our second book, Unspun, Finding Facts in a World of Disinformation. This book actually came out in 2007.
Sure. And I think that this is a great example, this idea that fake news is not new. It just has a new patina or a new name.
And certainly everyone's talking about it a lot more.
Sure. Absolutely. And so I think that, you know, Unspun and some of the other books that are out there are just as relevant now as they were when they came out, because they're still dealing with the same thing. If anything, we're dealing just with more information. So we need to even be more critical than, say, in 2007 when this particular book came out.
And why'd you pick this?
This one I liked because it really it talks about spin. Right. So we're used to probably hearing about, you know, spin doctors, and we need to be able to spin this information in a particular way. And so, again, this is a little bit of cherry picking in terms of there are lots of true facts. There are lots of things that we should believe. But depending on how they're presented, particularly if they're presented out of context, it could have a whole new meaning. If the cherry picked facts are then presented with something that might be false, then again, it has a whole new meaning than if it was just presented straight away in its entirety in the full context. So you've got ranges of spin again. So you could have omissions or little white lies, and then you could have spin on the complete opposite end where it's a whole new story. Maybe folks have heard that that old adage, statistics can lie, numbers
can lie.
Well,
I was going to say there's the lies, damn lies, and statistics, right?
Yes,
that's Mark Twain popularized that phrase,
right?
And that's just really the idea of picking statistics to bolster your position.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, so this goes into that a little bit more, too.
Yes, it does. It talks a lot about spin. And really, that's where the title comes from, How to Be Unspun. And so this idea that if you are unspun, you are being more critical of the spin, and you're not completely susceptible to what's being given to you.
Mm-hmm. The next book on your list is Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. How is this different than, say, Dan Levitin's book?
They're very similar. Blur is coming from more of a journalism standpoint. They talk about gatekeepers. And so, you know, I would consider you a gatekeeper for particular facts and news, right?
So I would consider myself a gatekeeper, too.
Absolutely,
right?
And so now there are so many because we're really getting into this deluge of information creation. Lots of people are blogging, people are podcasting, and it just gets to be you don't know who to trust anymore because there are so many gatekeepers. And I think Blur makes a good point in their conversation about the real digital divide is now between information creators and those who consume information without any type of critical lens. Mm-hmm. Because anyone can create information now. Anyone can spin information in a way that they see fit. And because we are so overloaded, it's that much harder to tell.
And Nicole, I'm thinking about, so this book was written in 2011, and I'm just thinking about in the past year, sites like Medium, kind of micro, I don't know if they're called microblogging, what you call Medium, but, you know, where, and there was a great piece that I read, and I probably read it on Medium. It was sort of like the cult of the paranoid Medium post. Mm. And I think everyone's seeing that now of everyone sharing this first person Medium account that is some historical depiction of what is happening now or other things like that. That's a lot of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, the bulk of this information is perfectly fine. Right. But, you know, because there's so many outlets and opportunities, you just never know.
Right. Right. Now, you also have another book on this list. Is it Meta Literacy?
It's Meta Literacy. So that is a book that comes more from my discipline of library and information science. And in libraries, we talk a lot about information literacy, which is really this, how do you become a critical thinker? We just have a different name for it. In other circles, you'll just hear it referred to as critical thinking, right? So all of these things are...
So meta-literacy is just another word for
just
critical
another
thinking.
Word. Okay. Yes, right. So meta,
that's good.
Yeah. So, but what meta-literacy really tries to do is to say to the reader, don't just focus on information literacy, or we hear media literacy, we could hear computer literacy, we could hear digital literacy. Meta literacy is saying, let's just look at this in its totality and let's just be critical thinkers as opposed to looking at one dimension and kind of checking that box saying, well, I'm digitally literate, but you may not be literate in other forms. So,
and why do you think this is so important now?
I think it's important because there's just so much information. Right. And when I was here the last time, we had two undergrads, which I loved what they were doing about
that.
They
created an extension
right. To
install to have Facebook into your it was an extension to tell whether or not sites, things in your Facebook news feed were accurate.
Yes. Yes. And I love what they're doing. And I think that that's a great tool. But I'm also a proponent of doing things manually. Right. Because only you can decide what works for you. And so we could have the extension, we could have all the plugins and all of these things to pop up and say, this is fake news. But maybe they're not 100% accurate, right, depending on the algorithms and the coding that goes in behind these tools. So people need to be aware and be able to see for themselves. They need to be able to take that information and decide what's really happening here. And they need to be able to just be able to do that at a moment's notice with these skills.
So, Nicole, what do you say to the people who are listening to this thinking, oh, I'm already so tired of the news already. I don't want to be educating myself about how to tell whether or not this is accurate or not, whether it's the news or something online. What would you say to those folks?
I would say, you know, if you want to read...
They just want to read Jane Austen.
Read Jane Austen.
Right.
Or, you know, and I think...
Or watch Victoria.
Absolutely. Netflix. Whatever works for you. I think there's room for it all. But I think in terms of some of this self-education, it's almost like you have to eat your vegetables, right? So it's not necessarily something you want to do all the time, but you know it's good for you. And then, you know, go watch Netflix on the weekend. It all works.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Nicole Cook. She is an assistant professor at the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois. Again, she's compiled a very helpful reading list for everyone. We tweeted it out. We'll have it at our website, 21st Show as well. As I mentioned, this is a series of conversations that we kicked off with Nicole that we're going to be doing regularly. And our next conversation, we want to ask you what kind of books, TV shows, other media, speaking of Netflix, what are you turning to if you are trying to find an escape from it all? We want to crowdsource that, compile some lists for everybody. We have a Facebook post up on our page. If you like us, search for the 21st. You can tweet us at 21STShow, or you can leave us a voicemail on our hotline. That's 217-300-2121. Again, that's 217-300-2121. Nicole, thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The book and movie Moneyball popularized the idea of using data and statistics for sports, in that case, to create better baseball teams. In the NBA, basketball teams have entire staff sections devoted to looking at player stats and reworking how plays are made. Well, at a completely different level, the Division III basketball team at the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago has teamed up with data science researchers to up their game, and it's helped the team quadruple their wins compared to last year. The team is at 18-5 right now. Pretty good record. On the line with us, IIT's basketball coach Todd Kelly and Shlomo Argamom, who's a professor of computer science and the director of the Masters in Data Science program at IIT. Todd, Shlomo, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Todd, let's start with you. Coach Kelly, IIT is a Division III school, so on the smaller side, maybe you don't have the resources. I'm thinking of a lot of larger schools, and of course they have in the NBA, to do these kind of data analytics. What gave you the idea last year that you might be able to tap into the academic side, the academic strengths of IIT, and use that to the advantage of the basketball team?
Well, you mentioned the lack of resources that we have, and we even don't even have a lot of the resources that a lot of other Division III teams have in terms of the staff, in terms of facilities, in terms of the budget, things of that nature. And so I'm a guy that's really into statistics and percentages and things like that. And so I just started to think, what is an advantage that our school could have that maybe some other Division III schools or schools that we're competing against don't have? And so that kind of led me to Shlomo and led me to talk to him about ways that we could include analytics and advanced statistics to be able to help our basketball program.
Shlomo, are you a basketball fan?
I am now. Let's put it that way.
Okay. What did you think when Coach Kelly approached you?
I thought this was a wonderful idea, something that I've been wanting to do more and more with the data science program is to help out the university in various different ways. And one of the things that I personally find very rewarding is working on projects with just a wide variety of different things. And basketball is a little bit further out of my wheelhouse than most. So it was very, very interesting, very exciting, and it's really exciting to see the results.
Coach Kelly, what were you? What was your goal when you started out? What was the hope of what kind of what data you would be able to gather, and then how you would be able to use it?
Well, I wanted my initial goal was just to try to find specific five-man lineups that would be the best in certain situations. For example, the best rebounding lineup, or the best defensive lineup, or the best lineup for end-of-the-game situations. And initially that was my goal, along with finding out what was each of our players plus minus. So basically how much did each player specifically contribute while they were on the court, and if they had a positive or a negative impact during their time on the court. And so initially that was my goal, but the students, Dennis and Larry, were able to kind of dive into the statistics even more and give me even more statistics than I thought I was going to get, which turned out to be very helpful.
Oh, okay. Before we get to that, I wonder, Coach, we were talking this morning, the producers and I were talking about the NBA and how many more sort of, for example, three-point shots are taken now because of data analytics. Before you got into specifics about your team, did you sort of pay attention to things like that and kind of implement sort of more general rules within your team before you even got into sort of the individual strengths of who your players are right now?
Not necessarily. And it's funny that you say that, because with the way basketball is going now, kind of how you spoke about, there's more three-point shooting and the way the basketball is going is you want to really try to get as many three-point shots as possible now. That's kind of what the data is saying. But ironically, our team is not a good three-point shooting team.
Oh, okay.
On the grand scale of things. But the statistics help me see other areas where we would have strengths and areas where we would have weaknesses. And I think most importantly, what the statistics showed me was that regards to certain players, that some players were really helping the team and some players were really hurting the team. And I think the players that were having a more of a negative impact, it showed me that, and eliminating those specific players, I think, really had more of a positive impact on our team.
Wow. So, Shlomo, Coach talked about two students. How many students did you have working with you, and what kind of information did they gather about the team?
Right. Well, on this project, there were just the two students, Larry and Dennis. As the coach said, they did a wonderful job. One of the big challenges here is we can't just look at the statistics of our team. We have to compare the statistics of our team to the statistics of the league that they play in. And those statistics are not publicly or easily available, and not every team gathers the same statistics. So they had to do a lot of legwork in trying to get enough statistics from the other teams and put them together into a way that we could actually calculate useful measures.
And what kind of things are you looking at? Are you looking at shooting? Are you looking at percentages? What kind of data were they gathering?
They were gathering all kinds of data. They were looking at shooting. They were looking at defensive plays. The different metrics measure many different aspects of the performance of a player. So there's some measures that try to estimate the overall efficiency of a player, how many points they're liable, you know, how much they contribute to the possibility of a team win per unit of time that they're on the court, for example. But we also can dive more deeply and say, well, some players are better at offense, some players are better at defense, some players are better three-point shooters, and so forth. So they're looking at all of this data, and they went back and they looked at videos of games to try to measure, to count how many three-point shots were made, how many three-point shots were attempted by the different players to figure out exactly what's going on.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, a lot of tapes. Coach, can I ask you a question? How big is your coaching staff?
Well, we just have two part-time. We have myself. I'm the only full-time coach on staff here, but I have two part-time coaches who do a great job for me. And then we have one graduate assistant coach. So that's in comparison to most Division III's. Most Division III schools have, you know, two full-time coaches and then have two part-time coaches, and then also have probably a graduate assistant and a manager or two as well to help out. So most Division III schools would have, you know, a staff of total of 5 or 6 people helping out. And to put that in comparison, most Division I schools would have probably 5 full-time coaches along with the graduate assistant, along with, you know, 4 to 8 managers. So they would have a total of 12 to 15 people total helping out the basketball
program. Right, who are looking at those tapes and reviewing tapes and reviewing plays. Shlomo, I imagine your students, they probably had to know a little bit about basketball, or maybe they learned a lot about it watching and reviewing and compiling all of this data?
Yeah, they came in knowing a fair amount about basketball. We looked for students, obviously, who had some background and a real interest in the sport. And I personally learned quite a bit about the game over the course of the project, much more than I knew when I started.
And, Coach, did the data match up? You mentioned that you learned more about your team's weakest players. Did the data that they presented to you, did it kind of match up with you, or what you already knew instinctively about the team?
I think a lot of it did, and I think that was the good thing about the data that kind of gave me a little bit more confidence because, you know, with the data, you can't just use the data and say, okay, this is, we're going to go 100% by what the data says, because a lot of coaches use their intuition or what we would call the eye test. And so what I did is I used my intuition and the eye test along with the data, and for the most part, the data pretty much backed up what I saw, but I think for those particular players who were having a negative impact on the team, I didn't realize that they were having the degree of a negative impact that they were having. And so I think that was something that the data really showed me. And like I said, eliminating the negative players really helped us out. And so that was probably the main thing that was a big difference from what I guess the eye test told me.
What's the eye test?
The eye test is when you see players and you try to evaluate them just based on what you see. You know, this player is better than that player. This player would be better in this situation. That player would be better in that situation, just based on the practices and the games and the preseason things that we do. So that's what most coaches use, and that's what a lot of coaches, you know, used, you know, obviously, you know, a while ago before we had all these advanced statistics. And so having the advanced statistics along with the eye test, I think, really can help coaches make better decisions on what players should be in the game, and not only that, but what players should be in the game with other players, because that was a big thing about the project too, is finding 5-man units that work best together in specific situations.
And how did the players respond to this information? You mentioned that you made some changes in the team, so I imagine you dropped some guys from the lineup.
Yes, absolutely. And the thing is, I think the players, they were very receptive, because one of the things about our players and our students at our school is that they're very, you know, process oriented. They like formulas. They like statistics. They like numbers. And so when they were able to see the numbers and they were able to see the statistics and the formulas, they were able to see, you know, who was helping, who was hurting, and who should be playing and who shouldn't be playing. So I shared a lot of the statistics with the players, so they were able to see this, and they were, you know, very receptive to it, and they really appreciated it.
Shlomo, I guess this is maybe a difficult question to ask, but I wonder if the players performed differently because they knew that they were being measured by data scientists. I wonder if, because they know that the students are out there and tracking moves, do you think that would have had an impact on performance?
As you say, that's a difficult question. It's very hard to say. One thing is that the statistics have been gathered, I think, for at least several years, even though we haven't been analyzing them in a detailed way. So they knew that they were that the statistics were being gathered, so that may have already made a difference. The other thing is that we're going to be doing all of this analysis again this summer, and possibly adding some more analyses, so we can compare. And we can compare and contrast in a detailed, data-oriented way the play of the players that were on the team last year and are on the team this year, and see if there are any differences. It's a very interesting question.
And, Coach, since you've started making changes based on the data, you guys have quadrupled your wins compared to last year. Are you 18-5 right now?
Yes.
And so that was last year. You were at 4-21.
Yes.
How much of the improvement do you attribute to this data? I heard Shlomo just say that some of the players are returning. I don't know how old the team is this year. How many of them are juniors or seniors?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons that the data was really important from last year to this year was because last year on our team, we didn't have any seniors. So we had all of our players were eligible to return. And, for example, this year we only have one senior that plays significant minutes and no juniors. So using the data from this year to help us next year would be very important. But what I like to say is, I think at the end of the day, no matter how much data you have, no matter what statistics you have. At the end of the day, the players are the ones who helped us win basketball games. And so I think if you look at, I think there were several factors that help us become better this year. Number one, you know, the team was older, so they were more mature, more experienced. We had better team chemistry because the guys had been together for a full year. They were, you know, bigger and stronger through our weightlifting and conditioning program. And then you throw the statistics on top of that, then I think all of those factors in one really helped us really improve. And to go from 4 to 18 wins, I mean, it was several factors involved. But like I said, I think at the end of the day, the players need to get a lot of credit for being able to execute the things that us coaches were trying to implement. And then for, you know, being able to back up what the numbers were saying. Because if the numbers say, hey, this lineup is the best lineup, but then the lineup doesn't go out and perform, then, you know, the numbers, you know, won't look like they were effective. But the players' performances were backing up what the numbers said as well. And so that was a big thing. But I think we can't let the fact that the players are the big reason and the main reason why we were a lot better last year to this year.
Well, and Coach, you're being very modest because you're not including any of your coaching skills in that as well. But I wanted to ask you, is there something that you wish you could measure that happens on the court that you can't measure with data that you would like to be able to?
Well, the only thing I think that you can measure, I mean, that I wish you could measure that data doesn't measure, and that the eye test is what really measures, is a player's toughness and a player's will to win.
And their mental sort of stamina when they're in tough situations.
Exactly. Like if there's a free throw and you're down one and there's, you know, a big crowd and the crowd's making noise, you can't really, you know, measure that per se. In practice, you only can measure that in games, and obviously you can, you know, you see the data and it can kind of back up what you may see. But I think the mental toughness and the physical toughness and just a player's desire and will to win are things that really can't be, you can't put statistics on those things.
Shlomo, do you think you can measure that?
We might be able to measure that a little bit, but not really. I think that as the coach said quite correctly, you know, it's the players, and I would add also the coach, that make for the wins. What the data science can provide is we can provide some insight. We can provide maybe a little bit of refinement to the coach's expert at intuition and to the understanding of the game that the players bring to it. But ultimately, it's a tool like any other.
Yeah, and Coach, to that end, I mean, I know that there is sort of, is now that there is so much data, whether we're talking about with any sports team now, there's so much more analytics that go into it as opposed to what you've been talking about, the eye test. How have you been able to figure out that balance of relying on your instincts versus the data? How have you done that this past year?
Well, you know, I'll obviously have the things that I thought were going to happen, or the players that I thought were going to be good and the players that I thought were going to be effective. And then I just took the data and kind of combined them. So I would say it's probably a 75-25 or 80-20 mix of, you know, the eye test or the intuition versus what the data says. And I think moving forward, not only in basketball, but in every sport, you're going to have to become more detailed with your data analysis and with the statistics, because you would be foolish not to use that tool now that it's available. So I think it's something certainly moving forward that will be vital to team success, but it won't be the only tool, and it definitely shouldn't be used as the only measuring stick. But I think, once again, you'd be foolish not to utilize additional resources if you're able to have them.
Shlomo, are you planning to do this with other sports teams across IIT?
We would love to do that. We're working with the basketball team, and as we advance further, we'd love to do it with all the sports all across IIT.
That's Shlomo Argamon. He's the director of Masters in the Data Science Program. He's a professor of computer science as well at IIT, the Institute of Technology. I want to thank Coach Todd Kelly as well, and I guess we should say go Hawks, right, guys?
Absolutely.
How many more games do you have left in the season, Coach?
We have two more regular season games, and then we still have the possibility of reaching the postseason as well. So,
all right. Well, we'll cheer for you for that. Thanks for joining us.
Right, thank you very much.
Nyla Boodoo, thanks for tuning in to the 21st on this President's Day. It's time for a little politics. On Mondays, we like to catch you up to everything that's been going on. And Illinois Democrats in Springfield are voicing opposition to Governor Rauner's budget proposal from last week. They're also gearing up to fight President Trump and some things they think he will be proposing. We have a resolution on the state worker pay lawsuit. Catching up all of you on this with state political news with two political reporters on the line with us from Springfield. Jordan Abadea is a political reporter for WICS News Channel 20. Joining us from Peoria, Chris Kergard is with us. He covers politics for the Peoria Journal-Star. Jordan, Chris, thanks for being here. Welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
Morning. Let's start with the latest on the budget. Governor Rauner presented us the budget last week. We've heard criticisms about the fact that it's not a balanced budget, anywhere from $4.5 to $7.2 billion in the red. There's a budget line. It actually says something to the effect of grand bargain compromise, kind of like as an asterisk in there for these numbers. Jordan, can you explain the gap here, this $4.5 to $7.2 billion?
Sure. So Governor Rauner has proposed a little bit more than $37 billion in spending, but the state's only expected to bring in a little bit more than $32 billion. And so in addition to some cuts and reforms that he did outline in his budget address that he says come with savings, there is about $4.6 billion in deficit. So he says that this will be made up when the General Assembly and the governor agree to a grand bargain compromise. Now, that compromise should include some kind of revenue along with more of Governor Rauner's turnaround reforms like pension reform, workers' comp reform, things like that. And so that's what they're counting on. They're counting on the General Assembly to come together and pass some kind of grand bargain. Of course, the Senate's already working on that right now. And that's what they're hoping moves forward by the end of this fiscal year so that they can get some kind of balanced budget resolution for the next fiscal year.
Chris, can you fill us in on the grand bargain? Last week, I think I had some guests in Springfield who were whittling down even grand is maybe not even applicable anymore because there's so many things that have been chipped away from this. Chris, can you remind us of what things are in the bargain that the state senators have been talking about?
Well, there's so many moving pieces at this point, and a lot more background discussion going on in this week that the Senate is off, that predicting what things are going to stay in, whether you're talking about additional taxes on some services or not, whether you're talking about that pension reform, whether you're talking about the workers' comp reform, whether you're talking about all sorts of other issues like that, it's very difficult at this point still to predict which of those things are going to remain in and which of them aren't. And one of the other challenges that they have in crafting a budget is that if you start to assume savings on some of those things, you aren't guaranteed that those savings are going to actually exist at the end of the line. I would use as one example of that, counting savings on pension reform, which is almost certain to be litigated, even if you have legislative agreement on it. We saw several years ago legislative agreement on a pension reform package that did not survive.
Right, that ultimately was not deemed constitutional, right, by the state Supreme Court.
Right, and when you count $1 billion or more in pension savings, and a court comes back 2 years after the fact and tells you, no, actually, this won't work, then you're out that extra money and you have a new hole blown in a different budget down the line.
Jordan, Chris has been talking about the Senate. Of course, there's been so much focus on the Senate because they've actually put forward something. Governor Rauner certainly spent quite a bit of time pushing that and praising the work that they've done. But I want to ask you about the House. What are we expecting with the House? What are we hearing from lawmakers in the House, Jordan?
So the House is not coming up with its own grand bargain of sorts as of yet. What we have heard from Speaker Madigan on Inauguration Day and since then is that Democrats are coming up with their own economic reform plan that doesn't hurt the middle class but can still make Illinois a more business-friendly state. So they have come up with that, and Governor Rauner has commended the Speaker and House Democrats for at least admitting that the state does need some pro-business reforms. And Governor Rauner has been very diplomatic throughout this whole discussion, and he's basically said, well, at least the House Democrats are admitting we need some reforms, and I'm open to hearing people's ideas and negotiating on what those reforms should be. We did see House Democrats pass a property tax freeze that is permanent. They've also agreed to start working with the governor on closing the Thompson Center just last week and looking at some of his other business reforms. And so the governor's taking that as a positive step. But there is no sort of grand bargain that would include revenue coming out of the House that we would need to balance the budget just yet.
Okay, we're not quite there yet. You know, Jordan, you mentioned pro-business, business-friendly items. Chris, I wanted to ask you about one item in the governor's speech. He talked about making the R&D tax credit, research and development, I should say, tax credit permanent. What's that about?
That's one of those things that's not necessarily a business reform, because we've long had a research and development tax credit, but the problem with it is that it's always been a temporary tax credit that's expired either a year, 18 months, 2 years at a time, and it's needed to be reauthorized. It's become sort of a negotiation point in any number of budgets, but it's absolutely crucial for companies like Caterpillar, and when you look up into the suburbs, other companies up there, Abbott Labs and AbbVie up in Chicago.
Sure, all the pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm.
Right, that continue to do massive amounts of research and development. Caterpillar spends the bulk of a $1 billion a year R&D budget in and around the Peoria area at its facility here, coming up with new material, and that includes any number of green changes to existing equipment, and they've been pushing hard, and other industry has too, to make that a permanent credit. They've been asking for that for years and have not gotten any traction under Republican or Democrat governors.
Jordan, any sense of that, making that permanent? Any sense of whether you think that might be a possibility?
I think as lawmakers look to work together and improve the business climate and do things that they can go back to their constituents and say, look, this is good.
We did something.
Yeah, I think that's definitely on the table. I think at this point, everything is on the table. And, you know, that's a tax incentive that's not really going to hurt the middle class in any way. Or it's not a burden on the middle class. And it's good for businesses. And so that's kind of a win-win for both people. I don't think there's a way you can spin that as not a good thing. And so I think that's definitely something that'll be on the table as a grand bargain is continuing to be built and move forward.
You know, another thing that lots of people agree on is school funding, or at least they agree on the need for how important that is. I should say, maybe we should start from there. Chris, you talked to the Peoria School Superintendent about the governor's call to increase spending for primary and secondary education. What's the sense in Peoria about what the governor said last week?
Well, certainly they're excited about the prospect, but they're also very guarded. I got some of the same responses from other people I've talked to that I received last year when the governor talked about increasing school funding overall, and that was great, but where's the money going to come from for it? And particularly now as they're talking about increased funding at the state level, but they're looking at the potential of a property tax freeze, which is where they've continued to grow additional funding in all of the districts around our area. There's some concern as to whether they might be getting more money from one stream, but have it strongly reduced on a different stream.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to a different topic. And just I wonder if we can talk this is, of course, related to the budget, but state worker pay, an ongoing lawsuit that was resolved late last week. Jordan, can you remind us what was this request? Why did Attorney General Madigan go after this? And why did the judge deny this?
So this all started when the budget impasse started back in July of 2015. And she essentially said, well, we can't pay state workers if there's no appropriation to pay them. That's not constitutional. A judge ruled that we were going to continue paying state workers based on his order. So we've been paying them ever since. Now that this compromise is on the balance and there's more things tipping in favor of compromise, the Attorney General said, okay, we're going to go back to court and see if we can get this order removed so that this puts a little bit more pressure on lawmakers to finally come and finally get a budget put in place. The judge did not agree with her. The judge said, we are going to continue paying state workers amid the impasse. Back then, the comptroller, Munger, actually fought this order that the Attorney General was trying to overturn and said, we can't, you know, pay people minimum wage. We can't, our computers are too old and dated. We can't sift out employees that are mandatory and ones that are not. And so this would just be a logistical hazard and we can't handle this. Comptroller Mendoza said that she was going to obey by whatever the judge deemed was necessary and constitutional. She said she would not pay state workers if the judge ruled otherwise because that would make her in violation of the Constitution. And so there was some politics being played amid this fight.
Right. We should point out Comptroller Mendoza is a Democrat. The important thing to sort of point out.
Right, and she beat Comptroller Munger, who was appointed by Governor Rauner and now works as deputy governor in his office. And so there was some politics being played around this, but I think what most people didn't realize was that there were a lot of state workers who were holding their breath, wondering if they were going to go into their job and continue to be paid to do the work that they do. This would essentially shut the state of Illinois down. And that's what many people have said is needed in this budget impasse, because if the state continues operating, there's no incentive for lawmakers to finally get a budget beyond the one that, you know, it's fiscally responsible. We're spending more money than we're taking in right now. But, you know, for almost 2 years, that hasn't been enough pressure for them to actually come and get a compromise on a budget.
Chris, is this matter over then? I understand Attorney General Madigan is appealing this.
Yeah, she's announced the day the ruling came down that she planned to appeal it. And if you go deeper into some of the politics that's being played with this, you of course have the governor claiming that that some of these efforts are intended to benefit the speaker and ultimately ram through another out of balance budget or a larger tax increase. I think you can take a different approach in looking at it, that if a Senate grand bargain does come together and this lawsuit is still out there in some form, and they're worried about the appellate court ruling in favor of the Attorney General's motion, that actually puts pressure on the speaker to go along with a grand bargain.
Let's shift topics entirely and go to Washington. Jordan, you've been reporting on how Illinois Democrats in Springfield are trying to buffer Washington and President Trump and things that he may be doing that may have an effect on Illinois. What are they doing?
So we've seen an interesting kind of package of bills come about that are in direct response to policies coming out of the Trump administration. We saw Representative Chris Welch is proposing a bill that would include safe zones for undocumented immigrants who are living in the state. They would be education schools. They would be places of worship. They would be hospitals. And so that was getting a lot of play. And he said this was in direct response to a lot of the rhetoric that he was hearing out of the Trump campaign and the Trump administration. And that, you know, he was hearing from constituents who were worried that, you know, they were no longer welcome in this country. And so that was a direct response to Trump's policies. And then there's another bill that would legalize abortion in the state of Illinois, because right now it's only legal because of Roe v. Wade. That's how the statute is written. And this one would legalize abortion if Roe v. Wade is overturned, which is a concern from Democrats and women who say that they're concerned about who Trump nominates to ultimately take over the Supreme Court, and he might make more than one of those nominations, and so they're worried about that. And we also saw some Democrats taking to the House floor and vocally voicing their opposition to what's coming out of the Trump administration. There are two House resolutions that condemn the travel ban and that also invite the Mexican president to come address a joint session of the General Assembly to talk about the relationship between Illinois' economy and the economy in Mexico. And so these are all in direct response to Trump's policies. And we're seeing lawmakers become more vocal about what's happening in Washington, D.C.
In Springfield, just to clarify that, which is yes. Thanks for that, Jordan. And I can't end the conversation without remembering a longtime Washington lawmaker, Bob Michael, passing away. Chris, you've been spending so much time reporting on his legacy. He was known so much for being a consensus builder. I can't help but think, do you think he would fit into today's politics?
I think that the very time he chose to retire is probably our best indication that he probably would not. And for those who don't recall, he announced his retirement in 1993, going into what was the Republican wave of 94, the rise of Newt Gingrich
to
power.
The Contract for America.
Right, the Contract with America. And some of that was Michael even being elbowed aside by Gingrich, who had been his deputy and was really throwing a lot of rhetorical bombs during those years. And he threw an elbow himself on his way out the door in Congress, arguing for more civility and decency and conversation between lawmakers. But much of what he built up from his era came from those personal relationships that became much more difficult to have in a Washington, D.C., where lawmakers had to travel home every single weekend to be with constituents. Bob Michaels' entire relationship with Dan Rostenkowski, Democrat from Chicago, head of the Ways and Means Committee for many years, was built up because the two of them would travel back and forth only the couple of times a year that they would come back to the district, would drive back and forth together from Illinois out to Washington, D.C., and you really bond with somebody in a 10-hour car ride.
Yeah, and that era, unfortunately, as you said, has gone. I want to thank Chris Kjærgaard with the Peoria Journal-Star, Jordan Abadea, WICS News Channel 20, for joining me. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for listening to The 21st, a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day.